We can get started. Go ahead.
Well, I don't recall talking much with Virginia, but I may have, so I'm going to let you do more of that introduction. But I have soil tests here from Virginia's last year, and then I just got the ones that she sent in for this year. And so we'll be discussing some of that on the soil test and the recommendations. Why don't you make the introduction then, Luke, with the for Virginia?
Sure. Well, Virginia and I had a conversation just a couple weeks ago, and she was so enthusiastic about how her garden turned out this year, and you know, we talked about doing this call, but. We spoke last fall, about a year ago, and, and then ordered the minerals and the different amendments, and then followed the program for this year. So it's 1 year with International Ag Labs on the Hybrid Garden Program. But Virginia, go ahead. Why don't you just tell your story? Again, this is just totally casual. It's not like a scientific thing. It's just tell us what happened, what you had experienced previously, why you know, how you heard about International Ag Labs and the Hybrid Garden Program, and, you know, what your experience has been with, so far.
All right. I got kind of serious about this in 2012. I had read Doc Beddoe's book, Nourishment Homegrown, which is on John's recommended reading list. And I live in north central Pennsylvania in the mountains, and there's not much dirt here, so I've really had to work at making a garden that will work for me. I've been gardening for about 10 years, just kind of hit and miss, you know, like a lot of people do. But as I said, I got serious about it when I read that book in 2012. And by the fall of 2013, I decided this was something I wanted to try. I didn't know about Ag Labs yet. And so in the fall of 2013, I started layering on the things that Beto mentions in his book. And I did the best I could with that. In the spring of 2014, there was a real change in the texture of my soil. It was much smoother, more friable, and it just really had a different texture that made it look like maybe this could really turn into good garden soil. So I grew a lot of things that year. I got enthusiastic, and I grew broccoli and Brussels sprouts and peas and green beans and carrots and eggplant and spinach and beets and tomatoes and potatoes and squash. It was just a normal garden, you know, and the results were kind of mediocre yet. You know, nothing was really kicking in, but I did not have a soil analysis. And I did the same thing the next year in the fall. And just layered it on like Beto says in the book. And still, you know, things were better, but they really hadn't come along like I had hoped. And then just searching around on the Internet for the components that I needed, you know, the soft rock phosphates and the high calcium lime, I came across the Hybrix Gardens and Ag Labs. So then I went for the soil test, and that was last fall. I put on all those, you know, I had the soil test, and so we knew what was wrong, and then I put on the amendments, and the results, I've been really gratified at the results this year.
Okay, and just as a background, I want to just explain what the amendments are that Dr. Beto has in his book. Typically, it's a very large amount of compost, quite a bit of calcium in the form of limestone, and then some high amounts of soft rock phosphate. So it's a really large amount of all three. Is that primarily what you did?
Yes.
Okay. So compost, soft rock phosphate, limestone, typically probably 100, even maybe even 150, 200 pounds in that range per 1,000 square feet would be normally recommended by in his book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I tend to be, you know, cautious, so I tried to be very particular about how much actually went on there. But I must say that in previous years, I had put on an awful lot of compost, humus, whatever that stuff is they sell in bags, you know. And
okay.
I was thinking, you know, that more must be better. So there was a lot of that, and I could see that it had created a problem.
Okay, and then just looking at the pattern in the soil, by the time we got your soil test in June of 2015, we see a soil test with an excessive amount of phosphorus and potassium, 1,200 pounds of phosphorus, 2,200 pounds of potassium, 3,400 pounds of calcium, and that was for your main garden. And so,
yes.
What
I really, even in trying to be cautious, I overdid it.
And so the numbers we're looking for is generally around 200 pounds of each, maybe pushing up to 300 pounds. So what we had was 1,200 pounds and 2,200 pounds instead of 300 pounds for the phosphorus and the potassium. And so that's kind of the starting pattern. And that's a lot of times what I see with people who follow Dr. Beddoe's book, that it ends up being pretty high. It does seem to affect the soil. You get better soil structure, but it's at the cost of the ratios that are high. So then you end up needing to go on a diet, in terms of a compost diet. No compost until these numbers start to come down.
Yes.
Okay. And that looks like you tested then in the fall of last year again for your main garden. And
yes, I did.
Your window garden.
Excuse me?
You also tested your window garden, your window bed.
Yes.
Garden.
Because I wanted to confine, you know, the greens and the fruit-producing vegetables. Keep them separated so that they'd be easier to spray and keep the energy, you know, at the proper level in the soil.
Okay, so then coming into this year, you haven't seen these soil tests, so you just got them out of the lab today. So you had, you know, real high numbers on your phosphorus and potassium, and then some instruction saying, okay, don't add any more compost because it's too much. And then looking at your results today, you have numbers, the phosphorus and the potassium are starting to drop.
So oh, good.
Phosphorus is from was 1,200 pounds, and then in the fall it was down to 1,000 pounds, and now it's at around 855 pounds. So your phosphorus is dropping. The potassium dropped a lot. It's down to 280. And that tells me you must have had a lot of produce this year. Because it sucked out a lot of potassium, so they must have put it into the food.
Okay. Well, yes, that brings me to the food. It was an adventure, I have to say that. I have tried to grow practically everything here, I guess. I tried corn last year, but that was in a different place, and it just didn't do very well. But at any rate, I've tried peppers before, and really, I'm sure that I could count on one hand the number of peppers I've ever gotten. This year, I planted four of the Carmen variety, and, well, there's basically been between 9 and 13 peppers on each plant at any given time through the summer. They just kept coming on, and the plants got 3 feet tall. I was just flabbergasted, you know, that such a thing could occur. And the peppers, now I bricked them. I don't know. I read some of your other interviews just a few days ago, And I see that brixing the leaves is important as well, but I only brix the fruits. So they were average, just about maybe average. And most everything I grew this year was around average brix. Some of it was a little bit lower. But, you know, homegrown is always so much better. So that was quite exciting to me. I actually got 3 eggplants this year. I mean, 3 fruits on my eggplant. The eggplants got a slow start. I don't know what happened to them, but they got a slow start. And I had flea beetles in the beginning of the season, and that might have slowed them down a bit. But I got 3 very pretty eggplants from the one plant. The broccoli, I had four broccoli plants. It's just my husband and I, so we don't need a lot of stuff. And I had 4 broccoli, and the heads on the broccoli were twice the size of the heads that I got last year. So that was kind of exciting. We took pictures. and of course, you know, broccoli just keeps on keeping on. We're still picking some from it now, even after a hard frost last night. So, and the lettuce did wonderfully. Let's see. Last year I grew some mesculine mix, and there was arugula in that, and I discovered that I love arugula. So I saved some seed from last year, and I planted them this year. And wow, the difference. I mean, the plants they grew into bushes, basically. Last year they were just, you know, little herb-type things, and this year they were just awesome. Carrots, I've not done well with carrots ever. The carrots usually fork at some point, and they've always been, they don't taste like carrots. You know, they're usually just too bitter. This year I got, none of the carrots have been, well, one was, but almost all of the carrots have been, they haven't been forked at all. They've grown big. I mean, I'm talking like 2.5 inches across at the shoulders. So, you know, this was like a totally new experience for me as well. So
how
it's
did
just
they
really
taste?
Been fun.
How did they taste?
They are not bitter, which is really an improvement. I brixed them, it was really hard to see. The screen, they were somewhere between 6 and 7, you know, which isn't great guns by any means, but they were not bitter, and that was the main thing. And they were orange, like carrots are supposed to be. So I was satisfied with that. You know, I'm hoping to get to that hybrid thing sometime soon, but this year this was enough improvement for me to just really be happy.
Well, Virginia, that's what really struck me when we spoke a couple weeks ago. It wasn't that you'd achieved hybrid across the board. Clearly, you had some imbalances with some of the previous amendments and things, and yet, even with the first year of kind of, you know, after getting soil tested and seeing what's there and putting on the right things and not adding more things that are excess and moving more toward balancing that out, you know, you're just sharing me with all these different types of vegetables that you're growing, that it was a big turnaround, that it was a big improvement. You're not there yet. We get that. But it was really encouraging for me to hear that as you were talking about, well, here's what my peppers were like, and now they're, you know, get a few little peppers, little 12-inch plants. Oh, they're 3 feet tall. They're loaded with peppers. I mean, it's really a dramatic improvement the first year, and from having bitter carrots to large carrots that are, yeah, they may not be high bricks, but and just so everybody knows, Virginia's not a market gardener. She's not a professional grower. This is just, you know, she's a typical backyard gardener who trying to do things right, and a lot of things are definitely turning around for you, which is really encouraging.
Yes. And this unusual thing, I'd like to direct this to John. This is something I didn't understand, but last year, I would say 2015, There were hardly any weeds in the garden. And it was the same way this year. I never had to weed this garden. There just were no weeds growing. And Luke said he hadn't heard that one before, so I wondered if you would comment on that.
I would say count your blessings. They're probably going to come back. I think that if you get the levels and ratios moving right, that does help a little, but I wouldn't count on it, and I won't make claims about that myself that will help you get rid of weeds, but I'm glad to hear that.
Yes. Well, I wondered, in Beto's book, he claims that the reaction between the soft rock phosphate and the high calcium lime has a sterilizing effect on the soil. And I just wondered, since I had dumped so much on there, if that might have been a result of that, or maybe just the high potassium, would that keep weeds from growing?
High potassium would probably keep a lot of weeds growing. In last year, we did not put soft rock on in the 1 year ago because you already had plenty. So we didn't do it, but you still had pretty good weed control. So that sounds it's a real blessing.
Yes.
So I'll say, if anybody has any questions for Virginia, please email me the questions at hybricsgardens@gmail.com, and I'll ask them. Virginia, you have a very nice story. It sounds like you really got a turnaround, kind of like it started to turn around, and you really can see a difference even on year one. I would like to point out that the first year, it's almost unrealistic to get high bricks on the first year unless you're starting with a pretty good soil, because the soil has to build up. And in your case, it's going on a diet. It's reducing the phosphorus potassium, and yet we're still having to keep the trace minerals and the calcium up, and those ratios are coming in line. And as they come in line, there's like a direct correlation between the flavor, the health of the plants, and the vitality. And so those are all coming in line. It's just at the beginning stage. One question I had, Virginia, tell me about, did you do the drenches and the foliar sprays? What's your thoughts on that, and how hard was that for you?
I did them. I did the foliar sprays and the drenches. this is probably the first summer in a long time that I've gotten up at 6 o'clock in the morning. but I did that, just to get out there and get at them before the sun was on them too much. And I felt that I don't know what mysterious things go on under the dirt, but they seem to be wonderful things for me this year, that's for sure. I used the transplant formula with everything that I planted, and I was there were a few things I raised from seeds, but most of the broccoli and the peppers and the eggplant, I bought those plants at a nursery that has a very good reputation for their plants. So, the transplant formula, I thought, was important for everything. And usually within a day of spraying, the plants just look different. I could always see, it's funny that you call that one drench perk up, because that's exactly what happens when the energy's starting to fall a little bit in the garden. You put that on, and it was, you could see the difference in a very short time.
Nice.
I planted in about the second week of July, I planted some cucumbers. I don't really care for cucumbers, but we were thinking of juicing. So I thought, I'll give it a whirl. They're supposed to be a pretty quick crop. So So I did that, and by the second week of August, I was starting to harvest cucumbers. The seeds grew, and they were old seeds. They weren't the best, but they grew. It was incredible. I had never seen grown things from seed that they got such strong stems on them immediately, and leaves, big leaves. I think I planted four, and I kept two of them. And like I said, in that very short time, they had grown and climbed up the trellis and were just looking beautiful. They had blossoms like I couldn't believe. There were just blossoms all over them. And then something bad happened, and the leaves started to get yellow spots on them. And I didn't know what that was, and I was afraid it might be contagious. So I had to pull them out, and it just broke my heart. But some of the older leaves were dying off, and so it might have been a virus or some kind of a worm, you know, that I don't know much about cucumbers, but since, you know, it looked like I didn't want it to infect other things in the garden, so I yanked it out.
Well, I would just kind of lay out a little thing. If this happens again, what you want to do is make sure that you bump up your foliar spray with Enthuse, which is trace minerals. It also has liquid seaweed in there. So that's just good for overall tonic for health. And then more specifically, to when you see issues with the leaves and a little concern, you can use a product called Showtime. It's not recommended on every garden, but it's a product that you may want to have just as to have on hand in case you need it. And it's an oily product, and so Luke carries that, and that would maybe do that once or twice a week during that infective time, and it'll probably between those two things, and then maybe sprinkle some transplant formula around the base. So those are and drench. So if you drench, transplant formula, Showtime, and Enthuse, you probably would pull that plant right out of its problem. I've seen
wow.
that happen quite a few.
Well, that's good to know. I do have all those things.
Okay. Did you use any transplant formula around the plants after they were up and growing? Just kind of tablespoon or two, just kind of sprinkle it around the top once it was going?
No, I didn't do that.
Okay.
I will write that down so I can do it next year.
Yeah, one to two times in a year, like about one-third into the season and about two-thirds into the season. It really helps bring conductivity on the surface with all the rain, that the nutrients kind of get pushed down. And if you put that transplant formula on the top, it does keep the conductivity up right there. And there's a lot of microbes going on as well.
Okay. Okay, I have a question for the two of you. Luke told me that I can get a lot of carbons in my soil with leaves. I'm in the middle of a forest, so I've got leaves. And he told me to use the RL37. So I'm wondering, should I mulch those leaves? You know, should I run them through the mower before I put them on the garden? Do they need to be dry? Or, you know, right now some of them are kind of green as they fall down. Am I being too picky?
I think if you – go ahead, Luke. You want to take it?
Oh, go ahead, John. You can answer that.
Okay. You can use some leaves, you know, if it's kind of fluffy, you can probably put 3-4 inches on there and then just kind of work it into the fall as you do the fall tillage and work it into the soil. You always want to be thinking about your potassium, and so your window bed is quite low. I mean, it's going to need a little potassium. It's at 158, so the leaves in there would be very good. Your main garden is down, dropped to 280, so it's very adequate, but it's not in any way short. So I wouldn't go excessive on that, not large amounts, but work some in. Probably if you spray a little like RL37 and then some microbial like Zehum and maybe a little fish or one of the drenches, say Perkup or something that's got some nitrogen in there,
mm-hmm.
and then those leaves will digest and break down over winter. I personally think leaves are a lot better than trying to grow a cover crop myself. Just you get more carbons that way. And I will tell you that by adding the limestone, you're also putting in calcium carbonate. So there's carbons right there that will digest and break down, and then that releases out of the soil as CO2, carbon dioxide, and then the plants will pick that up to make more sugar. So just by growing plants and by putting limestone down, you're increasing the carbons. So if you have leaves and you need a little potassium, leaves are fine. But it's not a requirement. If you don't have the leaves, for the listeners, limestone is going to be doing a lot of that work well.
Okay.
Yeah, the general principle, the question comes up about growing a cover crop, and then we talked about that and the difference between, there's nothing wrong with doing a cover crop, but a lot of times people want to do that to get more carbons in the soil, and by putting a layer of leaves in, you can actually get quite a bit more doing it that way, and using the RL and the Zehum to keep the microbial activity going. And so, yeah, it's a strategy we use in greenhouse growers a lot. That's a very intensive environment, and so they usually run longer seasons. There's not as much downtime, so it's a good way to help with that in a shorter amount of time. But it does work outside as well.
I just want to go back to your peppers, if you don't mind. If you're done with this, I want to just kind of mention a few things on the peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the things is peppers and generally have a more of a need for magnesium. And I've been working very hard to try to get magnesium into the garden program. And the way magnesium works is you need magnesium steadily available throughout the season. And so there's some magnesium in the CalMag drench. I don't know if you use that one. No, you use Perkup. At that time, I wasn't having CalMag drench. Now I have that, so there's magnesium there. Last fall, we put down 6 pounds per 1,000 square feet of Epsom salts. That's magnesium sulfate. And when you see the new recommendations, it will be with CalMag drench. So there will be a ongoing, every time you drench with the CalMag drench, that will have a little bit extra magnesium. Peppers really need that, and they need it for the green, and they need it just generally to get bigger. And so there is some of magnesium as well in the transplant formula. And I think a lot of people are eating foods that are minerally deficient in magnesium. So tomatoes need magnesium, peppers really need it, and some of the melons are very important to get high magnesium. So I'm very excited about putting that in the garden program. It's kind of been in the last 2 years that I've been using, 3 years, I've been using Epsom salts quite consistently. And it's surprising how much the crops take up, because you come back in and it's like, it looks as if I didn't even put it in last year. And it's like, it just sucked it all up.
Huh.
So.
Wow, that's interesting to know, especially when you mentioned melons, because my husband is, he always wants to grow watermelons, and we've tried. and this year I thought it might be better, you know, with the soil having improved so much, but alas, I was wrong. They're still pretty tasteless, so that's good to know that they do need extra magnesium.
I think when you are beginning the program, you're going to have some real clear victories. And yet at times, especially early on, you're not everything's going to come back and say, have it be as exciting as, say, the peppers. It's just you're going to have some things that just didn't do as well as they could have. And next year, you'll notice that there's more things that are better, and you will probably find something getting up in the high BRIC zone next year. Probably not everything, but something will get into that good range, and overall you'll notice, yeah, it's tasting better this year.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many, I've said this before, there really seems to be something magical about the third year. Everybody that I've talked to, nobody's ever said they saw no benefit. There's always some benefit. Some people, the first year, it's dramatic. Other people, it's more subtle. It really kind of depends on the starting point of the soil. Well, there's extreme excesses, it's more subtle because they don't go away overnight. When there's more depleted soil, those are the ones that tend to see pretty dramatic improvements the first year. But regardless, it's always better. And then the second year is even better. And by the third year, things really come together. Pretty much it's across the board. Some people sooner, some people a little later, but generally by the third year, following through, it's really working well. So you're off to a good start, Virginia. It's very encouraging. That's a pretty neat story, and just thanks for sharing it. Is there anything else that comes to mind at this point, or John, have any questions come in?
Yeah, here's a question from Mike. How did you know when to fertigate or soil drench? In other words, how did you know when soil energy had dropped?
Well, the plants, just start to look a little bit like they need something. They were going along so well, and then they kind of slow up a little bit, I guess, and that seemed to be an indication, as well as the time factor. I didn't want to put it on too soon after I put the plants in the garden, because that didn't sound like a good idea. I think you, I don't know if I read it somewhere or what, but you said like every 30 days. And so that, I kind of went by that. As the season progressed, it was more apparent the times when when things started to slow down. As the plants got older. But I don't know that I could say. I don't have a a conductivity meter for the soil, right. So I couldn't do anything like that. But it was just kind of looking at things, and because I go out and look at it every day, I really am an avid gardener.
Yeah, that was a really good question, and in the garden program, the recommendations call for doing a drench on a calendar schedule, either monthly. Lately, I've seen even every 3 weeks, and without a conductivity meter, that's a good program. Obviously, the cutting edge, the very best way is to use a conductivity meter. But they are a few dollars, and not everybody has them. We don't tell people they have to get one, but more and more backyard gardeners, for commercial growers, it's a must-have. And more backyard gardeners are seeing the value of that. And obviously with that, it takes the guesswork out. You don't have to wonder, because in reality, when we're doing either monthly or, say, every 3 weeks, it's kind of conservatively feeding the lettuce. If we, lettuce are light feeders, and tomatoes are probably the opposite end of the food chain. They're very intensely heavy feeders. And so really, if you drenched or kept the energy up to what the tomatoes really would need for optimal, you'd probably burn the lettuce. It'll probably just shoot right out of the ground. Just a joke. But, So doing that every month or every 30 days or every 3 weeks is, it works well for the light feeders, and it gives a really nice shot for the heavy feeders. It's not really optimal for the heavy feeders, but it's a good, short of getting a meter. But I know, John has told a lot of people, hey, if you can afford a meter, get one. If not, put it in your budget, because it's probably the most important tool you can have. They're a few bucks, but it's pretty impressive, and it's definitely the best way to manage soil energy. It gives you real-time feedback. Right now, you know, stick it in the ground. Okay, you're good, you're good. Well, you need some little energy here. You're good. We need to feed you. And so, you know, it's a little bit more involved. I mean, not everybody wants to do that. Some people just like, you know, I'm just going to drench everything every 30 days or every 3 weeks. But for those that do want to push the envelope, it's definitely the way to go. It's pretty neat, actually.
And I would add to that, very specifically, my recommendation is to get a field scout, and it's a direct soil probe, and not promoting the HANA instrument, which is cheaper. I've just had very good results with the field scout. And so I do say it's ideal to get a budget and just put it in the budget and get one eventually. Costs, you know, in the $300 to $400 range, depending on which of the two models you get. So it is pricey, but it's outstanding. And it's very much like if your baby is hungry, they cry. If your children are hungry, they say, I'm hungry. If your plants are hungry, they don't say anything, but they actually switch from thriving to surviving. And you're, Virginia, you're kind of picking up on that by just kind of watching your plants. But with a meter, you would instantly know, oh, it's starting to drop. And before it gets to surviving mode, which is also the disease and insect susceptibility mode, you want to keep the energy up before it drops. And so that's where the meter is really valuable. And I assure you, your increase in yield will eventually pay for that meter. It's amazing when you keep the energy where it should be, how tremendously productive your garden maintains itself, especially when you have done the full broadcast, use the transplant formula. It's like all the potential's there, and now if you just keep the energy up, it's starting to utilize that potential.
Yeah, I tell people that a lot. The base fertility determines the maximum potential. Like if you have low calcium, your minerals are out of balance, you're only going to get so much out of your garden. But so the getting the soil right, getting the base fertility, the levels and ratios determine the maximum potential. But in order to achieve, I mean, if we get no water, nothing's going to grow, right? If you got, you know, 30 days of cloudy weather, it's not going to be ideal. So there's variables that have to come into play, but the potential's there. The biggest variable that we have the ability to influence is to maintain soil energy. And by keeping the energy up, that is what allows the crops, you know, and the yield and the quality to achieve the potential. And I didn't say anything when you're talking about your cucumbers, but it's absolutely, probably very likely a low conductivity situation. The seeds took off, there was available nutrients there, and they were thriving and growing. And when the plants grow that fast and that productively, they're sucking up all the nutrients that they can get, and then they run out, and then they get weak, like John said. They get into, you know, survival mode, and then disease sets in. And so, we totally saw with the tomato plants at the tomato project this year. We had 4 or 5 weeks of intense heat and high humidity, and then we got pounded with like a week and a half of heavy rain. And all through that, it was really hard to manage the energy, and there's a couple issues with the fertilizer injector we were using and didn't have tensiometers, and we do now, and so there's different things we're doing to address that, but the end result was the energy was low and blight set in pretty heavily. But the cool thing, usually when late blight sets in, they're done. To me, they're over.
Mm-hmm.
The weather stabilized, we got back on, got a handle on, got the energy back up, running the right nutrients down the drip line. We got maintained the soil energy. It took off all the plants. They were like, we had a foot and a half, 2 feet of new growth at the end of the season. That it was like spring green. They were beautiful, lush.
Wow.
The plants kept right on going, and it was directly related to soil energy. If we wouldn't have got back on top of that, blight would have completely overtaken the plants. It would have been end of story. So it's a huge factor, and yes, the Field Scout direct probe is the way to go. And yeah, we have them because they work. But I've had like 3 or 4 different growers that went out and did get cheaper ones, and I don't know if they were the HANA or some other one, but they end up saying, yeah, I had some problems and this, that. They came back and got the Field Scout. So it is a very powerful instrument and very it's pretty neat how they work.
So okay, anyway, I have one more question.
Go ahead.
Is it beneficial to add sand to the soil where you're growing root crops like potatoes and carrots and beets and things like that?
I think the only benefit would be if you have an extreme clay and you need to just physically loosen some things up. If you're already seeing a loosening effect from what you've been doing and the things that you've already added, the soft rock, the limestone, gypsum, all of those things are very beneficial in loosening and opening up a soil. If you don't see the need for it physically, then I would skip it.
Okay.
Got a question here from Nagmani. She asks about what book you were talking about in her gardening, the title of it. And so the book is called Nourishment Homegrown by Dr. Alexander Beddo, B-E-D-D-O-E, I believe. And what I recommend is to read it carefully at the first half of it to get the principles and the theory that underlines what we do, but then skip the second half, which is to basically guess and just follow a program, which helps, but it would be better to start with a soil test and follow the soil test exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, I believe he does recommend the soil test in there.
Okay.
So, you know, my bad, I guess. I should have done that in the beginning. But
well, I didn't know about it either, where we were at.
Right. Now, I also read Bread from Stones. That was such a good book. I found that really inspiring, you know, that someone that long ago, without all these technological devices that we have now, would make such inroads in that field, and yet at the time, you know, I believe it was Germany, and nobody was really buying it. You know, he did wonderful things, but it was a hard sell, you know, because fertilizers had come on the scene
I will tell you that in my mind, Bread from Stones is one of my top books that I, every so often, I want to refer back and go read it. And this book was written by Julius Hensel. It's an outstanding book. And then there was a disciple of his who studied his works and took a number of tracts and wrote another book called Bread and Roses from Stone.
Wow.
And you have to go to used bookstores. What I would do if you want that is go to bookfinder.com and search for Bread and Roses from Stones. And the basic premise of those books is that the trace minerals and a lot of the minerals that plants are short of are actually bound up in rock material, and that by grinding them very fine, the biology breaks down and liberates those trace minerals from the silicate encasing almost and releases those minerals, and it makes a big difference. And if you look at the fertility program for Hybrix Gardens and you look at what all the program is, we have, for example, Virginia, we had GeoCal, GMB, which stands for Trace Mineral Blend. When the phosphorus comes down, we will use soft rock phosphate. There's kelp meal, there's sea minerals, and those are all things that provide broad-spectrum trace mineral rock powder. So some of them are from ocean-derived, like the kelp meal and the sea salt, which is high in iodine, and the majority, in terms of pounds, are resources that are on this earth that are full-spectrum nutrition, so like the GeoCal, the TMB, that's short of iodine but rich in silicon. So you need both. You need ones that are rich in iodine and ones that are rich in silicon, and you need that. And the biology in the soil needs to have a job to do, and that job is to digest rock powders. And so part of where you're getting this increase in flavor is coming from those rock powders. And I would encourage everybody to read Bread from Stones. Dr. Reams was influenced very strongly by Bread from Stones. And if you look at, I think it's the second chapter, and it's the benefits of stone meal. Well, that, if you look at it, it's old words and terminology for high bricks gardening. And Dr. Reams took it from there. It is not unique to Dr. Reams. He just took it, and then he realized, oh, the refractometer gives a bricks reading, but the message was already known in the 1880s by Julius Hensel. So that's the highest recommendation I can give as a foundational book to read.
Yes, I certainly enjoyed it.
And now I'll get off my soapbox.
It's a good soapbox.
I haven't read that myself, but I've heard other people refer to it. And so, yeah, that sounds like a good read. I should get that myself, too.
I'm done with questions. Anything else that you would like to share, Virginia, or ask us, or Luke, that you want to share?
Well, okay, maybe this is a little out of line. But if you had a soil, I mean, this is just something I've been percolating on. If you had a soil that was mostly clay, or at least it felt like clay, and it had a lot of calcium in it, and the pH was like 7.7 or maybe even 8.
Hey, you're talking about my garden. <Keep
going>. Okay. Do you use gypsum on that? Or, I mean, gypsum sounds like the one, you know, to pick that would actually help to lower that pH, plus give you a better kind of calcium.
No, you look at the available calcium. And so if you said if it has a lot of calcium in it, the question is it available calcium? If it's not available, you always use limestone, irregardless of the pH.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's a little bit like gypsum and limestone are looked at as, okay, for low pH soils, you use limestone. For high pH soils, you use gypsum because it's not so high pH. But that would be very similar to having a straight slot screw, and that's like limestone. And then you try to bring a Phillips screwdriver, and you try to get that screw unloosed with a Phillips screwdriver. It doesn't work, okay? And that's exactly the picture you should have in your mind. Don't ever think that gypsum substitutes for limestone. It doesn't. Gypsum is its own tool. It's a wonderful tool, but it is needed when you need to open and loosen up a hard, compacted soil. It is needed when you need to drive out some of the sodium because of an excess sodium or excess of cations, some excess of the sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium. It'll help to set those ratios better. And the other thing is if a soil is going anaerobic, and so you can tell by looking at our soil test where it says ORP, which is oxygen reduction potential, and it's a measurement of the soil. If it's too anaerobic, it's going to be a low number. It's like a 26 or 27, 25. If it's right in the middle, 28 is good. If it starts to be 30 or higher, that soil is oxidizing. When that soil goes anaerobic, there is no substitute for gypsum. That is the tool to use. But it doesn't take that much. And we're talking 300 to 500 pounds an acre, or about 5 to 12 pounds per thousand. That's it. And so that's where you use gypsum. And if you have low calcium, you use limestone, period.
All right.
Now, that's very different than what you'll hear elsewhere, but I've done this on thousands of soil samples, and I know it works.
Right. One other thing, if I could add to that, so many people, you know, agreeing with what you said, John, most people see and understand limestone to be strictly a pH-moving agent, and we don't really use it for the pH. We use it for the calcium. And so many people, I can't tell you how many, if they have low calcium or even high calcium and a high pH, wondering why are we putting on limestone. And I just, you know, the reason we do that is because the calcium is far more important than the pH. And when things are balanced and growing better, the plants are growing more prolifically. There's more root hairs. The plants are giving off more fulvic acids and humic acids, which will naturally bring the pH down on its own. So I tell people it's like looking at a tree. You know, the pH is a tree. The calcium is a tree. The ratio between these two things is a tree. So we need to step back and look at the health of the forest and not focus on one tree. So many people look at the pH and calcium or no calcium based on the pH, but that's only one tree. We need to look at the whole forest. And that comes up a lot as far as why are we using calcium when the pH is already high? Because calcium, the need to get the calcium where it needs to be far trumps, even if it's a temporary pH move in the wrong direction, that will buffer itself out naturally over time when we get everything else right. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And one thing I would just emphasize, Virginia, just kind of more broader looking at your soil test, because you have very high phosphorus still, even though it's moving in the right direction, you want to make sure that you're not adding compost or manure at this stage. And maybe later you would, but right now not. And then the other thing is because we're also taking minerals off in the form of food, and maybe even if you take and pull out weeds or whatever, minerals are leaving, and so you want to come back every year without fail, once a year, and you look, okay, where's it at now? What do I need to add? What should I avoid? And so, for example, you're really short on your trace minerals, and so we really got to work on calcium and trace minerals in your soil.
Okay.
So
I think I lost you guys.
Okay, can you hear
me? No, we're...
Okay.
Are you there? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. One more person, Mike, had a question about using limestone regarding potatoes. Did you grow potatoes?
I did.
How were they?
And it's funny, but they were very disappointing this year. And I spoke to someone else who said that whoever she talked to, and she had, you know, she knew several people who grew potatoes, and they just didn't do well this year here. We had a drought in July, which apparently you did as well, and then we got rain like you wouldn't believe. And, you know, those two things are just not real good for anything. So, you know, even at that, I was surprised at the results I got in my garden. But, no, I have grown better potatoes in years previous. And more. I only planted six, which I don't usually plant too many because we don't eat a lot of potatoes. But in the past, there have always been four or five potatoes at least for each plant. But this year, I think there were maybe three and no more. They just, it was like, the plants just said, this is all I'm doing.
Were they scabby? Were the potatoes scabby?
Not particularly. But, yeah, there was a little bit of scab on them.
Okay. So Mike asked about using limestone regarding potatoes. His are scabbing, he says, and his has got a pH of 6.6. I've asked a lot of people on the garden program, because I have to make a garden program for all crops, there's many different crops in there, and I put a lot of limestone in and not as much gypsum, I've asked, and the general thing that I've seen is once you get on the garden program a year or two, overall, the potatoes get bigger, they certainly get a little higher bricks, they taste better when you cook them, and they're not scabby overall. If you're still coming off of a first-year program, sometimes you can have some scab, but I think you'll overcome it. And with a 6.6 pH, you shouldn't be having scab, but you are. So I think it's just a matter of keep working through excesses or deficiencies, and you won't see much of a problem when you work through that. So that's my response to Mike.
Okay.
Well, anything else, or we should wrap it up?
Does anybody have any kind of cure for flea beetles?
Cure for flea beetles.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Well,
I hope so. That, you know, they were a little bit of a menace early in the year. So they ate through a lot of leaves, and I did finally throw on some diatomaceous earth, and I grew some catnip because I had read that catnip will discourage them at least. And between the two of those things, it seemed to help somewhat. So that's okay. All I have to say about that.
Well, the general principle, as the soil gets better and the plants are healthier, insects leave on their own. So I've just seen it time and time again, and people report that, and that's all I had to say. I mean, I just literally keep doing what you're doing and it'll get better.
Yes.
I believe that.
I think so.
Yep, I was going to say about the same thing. So.
Well, it's been lovely to chat with you guys.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your story. And we'll be having some more people come on. And if you're interested in sharing your story, please tell our talk to Luke and I. We're looking to get a collection of these just so people can get some other experience. And so this is coming from Pennsylvania, higher rainfall area. Never started with the perfect soil, but definitely making great progress in a year's time and the foundation she had from following Dr. Beto's approach. So thank you, Virginia.
All right, thank you.
Virginia, thank you very much. This was a good call. Appreciate your time. And thank you, everybody, for joining. I guess we'll wrap it up here. Until next time, thank you.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.